It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Me, Ernest Hancock, Phoenix, Arizona, but we got every reason to be. A lot of times, what keeps you from being afraid is just having understanding, foreknowledge, knowing what's coming. You know, it's you can't really get startled. You know, if they're, you know, somebody's throwing a baseball at you, you know, if you're standing there and you're expecting it and you got a bat, you know, that's no big thing. You know, but if you're just standing there and somebody throws a baseball at you, you get scared. You know, even though you know it's coming, it goes right in front of you, a foot past your face, and you're like, "Man, it's all good," you know, because you know. Well, if we can explain it and understand it, does that desensitize us? Is it better? Do we need to be scared? Do we need to be prepared? Well, I want to get prepared, and there's a couple of things that we still need to go over, but I want to get into some predictions. I mean, we could sit there and look at Europe. It's happening right before our eyes. And one of the things is, Dr. Paul, that was the one thing he was really going on about. What'd you do with the money? You know, where'd it go? How is it that the Federal Reserve or the U.S. taxpayer is somehow on the hook for foreign banks and foreign countries? I don't remember signing off on that. You know, where's that? We just want to know. We don't want to tell you, but we should know, but we don't want to tell you. But if we knew, then we'd probably, but then that would affect the monetary policy. We're not going to tell you because then you would, you know, make a stop. So we're not going to tell you, you know, so that's what is, you know, kind of the ouch quit it going on right now. And Charles, you know, what just happened in the Senate? You know, what was the bill? What happened? What they tried to take out? What did they probably put back in? And what the end result is now? Because I know, you know, Kyle, we have two senators here, John McCain and Kyle. John McCain, he's run for re-election. He's like, oh, yeah, we got to have an audit. You know, who's he kidding, you know? And then Kyle, he's not up for another 4 years, so he's like, oh, I vote no.
It made me so mad, particularly. I mean, it's one thing if the vote on this had happened in isolation, if we weren't in the middle of a crisis already, if we hadn't lived through this mortgage meltdown, if the Fed hadn't exploded its monetary base with all this crap that is going to come home to roost to cost us all dearly, if they hadn't been doing, just within the last couple of hours, decided to do currency swaps and secret little bailouts for the euro and Greek debt and so on, if it had just happened in isolation, maybe nobody would have noticed that Kyle voted against the Fed audit bill. But it happened at a time when it was screamingly obvious that we badly needed to see what these clowns are up to with the future prosperity prospects of the American people. And he votes no. He votes against it. And it made me so mad. You know what I think about electoral politics. And yet it made me so mad. I mean, the stuff makes my skin crawl.
Well, you know John Kyle. He's come up on the show, and you knew what kind of person he was.
But it made me for a second think I ought to run against him just to give him a challenge.
No!
No, I mean, I wouldn't do it because it's so distasteful. But, I mean, it's like, you know, that was to me the final straw. It's just unbelievable. We are being fleeced at an accelerating rate. We're on the cusp of the ugliest fiscal crisis we've had in this country, and he votes no.
Special little Nuremberg trial for him.
Unbelievable.
You know, that's a good question. I mean, who is to be ultimately held accountable for this? It's not like the people aren't complaining. I mean, heck, around the world, you got them in the streets. Here, we're going, hey, man, you're in the Fed, and you got the whole young generation. They're going, oh, by the way, you're going to owe the money. And the young people are going, no, we're not. You know, so it's who do you blame? I mean, who do you go after? Somebody is going to be left without a chair when this all comes crashing down to get blamed.
I blame the American people. It's really fun, and I spent a long time in my media life blaming politicians, blaming educators, blaming elected officials, blaming the media. This is all great sport. It's a lot of fun, and there's plenty of blame for all of them. But really, when you get down to it, who bought the book of lies? Who bought it all? The American people. The American people were willing to buy things that they knew weren't true because they thought they would get something for nothing. You can create money out of thin air. No child would believe that. You can spend your way to riches. No child would believe that. But the American people were willing to nod their head and dumb. Yeah, okay, if they say we can create money out, they know best. They're the experts. Oh, we're going to spend our way to prosperity. Okay, they know best. We're the experts.
They created this populace. They spent tens of trillions of dollars over generations to put us in a position to not even know any better or to even know what the right question was.
Well, the fault is the people.
No,
the
ultimately, you know, people. You know, they're going to, well, I tell you whether it's their fault or not, it's going to be their responsibility.
Yeah, sure. They're the ones going to suffer the losses. They're the ones that are going to suffer the consequences of this currency breakdown. It's a very tragic event. It's not a pleasant thing. These things aren't pleasant events. It's a very, very tough time. And it stresses the entire social fabric of the country. And you can end up on usually these things end very, very badly.
Well, I'm, and that's one thing that we can talk about, you know, given a historical perspective. And that's one of the benefits of your book, The Dollar Meltdown, is I suggest you guys get it. You want an edumacation? I mean, you need to get it right, not later. Because if you don't, you're not going to understand what their next thing that they're going to offer. You go, yeah. They already did that. They tried that in this century here. They did this. This was the result. This is what you can expect next time. This is how it's going
to
be done.
I went to a lot of trouble to do that. And the book is divided into four parts. The first one is where we are. And it describes all this stuff in very comprehensible form of, you know, the size of the debt and why it's so big and what it means for each one of us. The next part is important, is to understand how we got here. It's a little bit of the history of money. You see monetary systems throughout history that have worked. It's not a history book, but it gives you a brief introduction to things in history that have not worked, too. Monetary systems like Zimbabwe and the great German inflation and the reign of terror inflation. So we move through those things rather quickly so you get a sense of how those things unfold and what a real sound monetary system that creates prosperity is. But the next important part of the book is part three, what happens next. Now, the fourth part is what do you do about it? But I want you to pause and linger when you buy the book, when you read The Dollar Meltdown, to pause and linger on what happens next. Because I went to a lot of trouble to forearm you. Nobody, I'm not an astrologer, and I'm not Nostradamus. And nobody can tell you exactly how things will unfold in the future. You can take a snapshot today and say, you know, here's the momentum, here's the velocity, here's where we're going. These are the things that have to be reckoned with. But there's always a little twist or turn in the way that it unfolds. So I describe the historical precedents so that in a year from now or 2 years from now, when the president gets on TV and says, we're making a big announcement and here's what we're going to do, or Congress decides we're going to do this, or there's a new monetary agreement, you'll understand what it means and what the consequences will be without buying another book. You buy this one and you're fixed for the next few years, because I give you all the precedents so you can understand, you know, if they announce this, if they plan that, they will constantly come up with new plans to deflect the blame for the mess that they have created to begin with. And I want you armed to understand what each one of those means, because, listen, your primary job is to protect yourself and your family. You can profit from this calamity, and you can protect yourself and your family from this. Oh, it would be a lot better not to have a calamity. Too late for that. It is true that no matter how much you profit, all of our circumstances are going to be diminished. All of the opportunities in our life are going to be fewer because of this. But even so, you can protect yourself and your family. You can do something about it for yourself, and that's what I've created this book for, The Dollar Meltdown.
It is dense, but it's not. It's dense because it has so much information, but it's entertaining. I mean, it's almost like reading a novel.
Yeah.
I mean, it is just, I take it on all my trips. I got to admit, I still got like 20% to go. But, you know, it's because I got the first book. That's why. Yeah. And I don't want to be taking it around messing it up, you know. So when I go on the trips, you know, I'll have it in my bag. I'll take it off to the plane. That's when I usually read it, is on the plane. And it is just the flights go like that. It's just, man, I devour it because it's so dense in things that are of current news. I mean, you can sit there and watch the news and you go, man, did Charles peg that? So now what I want to do, we know what's going to happen next. They're going to, if I had to pick one thing that we can pretty much count on, they will continue to increase money supply.
Yep.
They will inflate, and eventually, sooner or later, they can rev up their engine, and you can have the starting tree, you know, clicking whatever color until the clutch gets released, and there goes the drag car. But I'm telling you, it is sitting there ready to get dumped into the economy, and it already is. A lot of it already is. But, you know, we just took it off the first shoe and smelled the smelly sock. We haven't even dropped that one yet. They go, oh, the other shoe's going to drop. Are you kidding me? We haven't even started dropping shoes yet. This is going to get really ugly, and I insist on one thing, that you survive it. Because on the other side, freedom!
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Why we do this. There is a reason. Oh, man, you can't declare your independence if you're dependent. You know, stop being dependent. And how you get to be independent is the first thing you got to know what you need to be independent of and that have the capacity. So this is Charles is the person that asked for this, and we got a lot of this in his book also, but this has happened before. Now, this is, I mean, it keeps happening. And I tell you what gets targeted. The most prosperous currencies are the ones that get, because they have the most prosperous countries, most prosperous people, the most to take. So they're going, ooh, man, you got some goodies. You know what? How do we take your ledger of goodies and move it into our ledger of goodies? Let me tell you how we do that. Let me think. I care not what laws are made or who does it, just I get to print the money. Okay? So here we have America, shining light, you know, the blowtorch on the hill, and we have, that attracts all the moths, and here they come, you know. So they've attacked us. They've taken our dollar good as gold, and it's not anymore. What happens, though, Charles? I mean, this has happened before. What can we look forward to?
Well, as I say, it's usually very ugly on the other side. Look, the middle class, to whatever extent it exists, and by the middle class, I mean whoever those people are who live between, the Middle Ages, between the kings and the very lowest serfs. So maybe it's the merchant class, the shopkeepers. So whatever the middle class consists of is the best bulwark you have for liberty. Because the poorest classes become dependent on the government first, and the wealthy classes run the show. So the middle class throughout history, you want to destroy the people's freedom, take out the middle class. It's the first thing that's got to go if you want to take the people's freedom. So what happens in these currency crises is the elimination of what is effectively the middle class, and you can see it in the reign of terror inflation in France from 1789 to 1795. And by the time that the radical socialists that had grabbed the government there had ruined France, ruined the French economy, by the time that was over, you had a disaffected entire population, impoverished nation, and it prepared the way for the rise of the dictator Napoleon. And with the dictator Napoleon, you had, you know, like 18 years or whatever it was of war and millions of deaths across Europe. The same thing happened in Germany. With the smoldering resentment of the wiped out middle classes in Germany in the Weimar Republic inflation from 1919 to 1923, you eliminated the middle class, and you had people knew how they had been fleeced by this transaction, and they turned to a strong man. They always turned to a strong man, and they turned to the National Socialist Workers' Party in their resentment. And so you had Germany ignited in flames then for years, more millions of deaths, and the reign of terror of France, it was 40 years after they had destroyed the economy, 40 years before the prosperity of the people got back to where it had been before 1789. took 40 years to get back. It was the same thing in Germany with the destruction of the German economy. Even the end of World War II did put them on the road to prosperity until a couple of economic events. By about 1948, they started to recover.
Well, the recovery always is a result of what? I mean, you have the Marshall Plan comes in and just starts throwing money at them and had controls and said you can't and rationing and you got. And finally, it just got to the point, you know, I think it was in your book you were talking about that. They said, you know what? We're just going to go to this free market thing. Boom. Solved.
Solved the problem. Totally solved the problem. This is the most fundamental axiom of history, is that prosperity is the creation of freedom. And it always amazes me that people don't understand it, but it's a great object lesson in Germany after World War II. Do you realize the occupation government, the American occupation government in Germany, used the same rationing and the same price controls that the Hitler Nazi regime had used? So you defeat the Nazis, you defeat the centralized state, you defeat Hitler, and what do? You persist in using his economic system.
You transfer the ring!
It's unbelievable.
I get to wear the ring now! Yay!
So the German people were impoverished. They'd been broken by war, and they remained impoverished in the occupation government, and things were bad, and of course there was no reusable currency. I mean, that's why you see those old World War II movies, and they talk about, or post-World War II movies, they talk about chocolate bars and nylon stockings and stuff as a currency unit, because the currency otherwise was absolutely worthless. Well, what finally happened in Germany is that there was an economics official by the name of Ludwig Erhard. He was a kind of a treasury official. Let's call him a treasury guy. And one weekend in the occupation government, when he knew that the Americans were on holiday, he went on national, so the American occupation government wouldn't be able to object. They were away on holiday. That's what Americans do. So he went on national radio, and he said, today is the end of the price controls in Germany. And he just unilaterally abolished him. And General Lucius Clay was the commander-in-chief of the occupying United States Armed Forces. And he came back in at the end of the holiday weekend on Monday, and he says, my advisors tell me that you've altered our wage and price controls. And he goes, no, mon general, I haven't altered them. I have eliminated them. And General Clay says, well, you know, my best advisors tell me that's a mistake. And Erhard says, well, don't worry about that, because my advisors tell me it's a mistake also. But they eliminated price controls, and all of a sudden the shops that had been empty were full. And all of a sudden people had to stand. People weren't working. They weren't producing anything. They were spending their time queued up in lines to get, you know, a scrap of bread, to get their rationing and stuff. That's where the productive effort was, standing in line in a Soviet socialist, Hitler Nazi sort of economy. People stood in lines for a living.
Backed up by the United States military.
and they call it, even economists call it, the growth was so fabulous, so fantastic, they call it the German economic miracle. And, you know, most socialists and stuff, they don't understand what something happened. It must have been cosmic rays emanating from Mars or something. But all it was freeing up the economy and getting the government out of the way.
And is that what we're going to have to look forward to here in America?
You can't tell. Here's the problem.
I'm telling you, that's what we need.
Yeah, you can't tell.
And they're
going
to be coming with the brown shirt, goose-stepping, Obamaite, whatever the heck they're going to call it, and saying, you can't, you should, you got it. And then we saw it in the Clinton administration with the baby formula and diaper hoarding thing, and you're a terrorist if you got too many diapers, and you're doing, and I'm going, what? You know, and we had the same thing when they did the gasoline thing. There was a main line that broke gasoline here a few years ago in Arizona. And you had the main problem is that we had a special mix or something they had. We could have had tanker trucks would love to come and bring the fuel from Los Angeles. They were begging to. They had to get Napolitano had to say, okay, I guess we can have a different kind of gasoline. Yeah. And it was just so stupid. And what did I do? I took my radio show and I went to the one that the NBC affiliate was going on, because these guys were charging $4 or $5 a gallon for gas, and they're going, we're going to tell people never to come shop here. You're hoarding like that. I said, you know what? I'm going to do a live remote from the inside their store. And I sat there all day, and my whole thing was, you know what? They have gas. They would bring a tanker, would come up, and it would fill it up. Everybody would be following the tanker, wanting to get filled up with gasoline, and they wouldn't turn on the pumps. And they go, why? Well, we're waiting for the gasoline guy down the street to run out so we can charge more.
But here's what I want people to pause and consider about this. this. Why is it? Yeah, the politicians, in the face of that shortage, they could not wait to start instituting rationing and price controls and criminal prosecutions. But let me ask you this. This is an important question for you to sit there and ponder in your home today as you listen to this program. Why is it that $4 a gallon gasoline is so very, very bad in the midst of a shortage by some operator who has to go out and search and find it and get it in the tank and then stay open at night to sell it to people? Why is it bad when it's $4 a gallon because he's selling it, but it's okay when it's $4 a gallon because the Federal Reserve has destroyed the currency? Why is it okay when the Fed makes it $4 a gallon, but it's bad when the gas station operator raises
prices? You want to have supply? The price goes up. People were going and getting 55-gallon drums in their pickup and going and getting the fuel to bring so that we could have it. You know, high prices eliminate shortages. That's the whole point we were trying to make. Oh, well, we're going to have a new economy. Get ready.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, longtime friend Charles Goyette, superstar, telling us all what's up. I get to call you an economist after you write the dollar meltdown.
I'm not an economist, but I play one on the radio.
Yes, you do. Yeah, heck, a lot better, more accurate. Well, you know, the other side of this, I think we can, you know, you might want to spend a little bit of time on crack up boom, because I think that will, you know, be the last signal that people need to know that it's coming. But after we go through that, I want to get to the point before the end of the show, is that there is another side. Once this happens, it happens. There's not a dang thing they can do to stop it. That's where we're at now. They can't stop what's coming. They can't. It's math. I'm planning my entire life, that of my friends, children, all my activism, everything is around. It's going. And we're going to detail what's going to happen. What happens then? I have no freaking idea. Because, you know, the solution is what always has been the solution is I break with thee, and you throw dog poop on her shoes. I mean, you know, it's and you want to go hang out with the, you know, the people that, you know, that have done that, and you create your own economy, and you just, you know, get off of it, and we're good. Because everybody, you know, there's so much wealth destruction. And I'm going, yeah, well, I guess they'd probably want to, you know, build that back up. How do you do that? Not by the same method that they took it away from to begin with. So let's get to freedom. What's the proper role of government? Defending individual rights. What's your right? My property. You know, this is so fundamental, and why Dr. Paul makes such a big deal about, you know, getting back to the fundamentals. But let's talk about the crack up boom, because I think that's what people are going to see.
It's a wonderfully evocative phrase that comes from the great economist Ludwig von Mises. He called it the crack up boom. The crack up boom is what happens when economic conditions start getting bad, a currency crisis begins to develop, and prices are going up and so on and so forth. But suddenly it's like a transition when suddenly everybody starts to realize that this is going to go on forever, that the money is going to continue to lose purchasing power. Suddenly the consciousness of everybody clicks like a switch has been thrown, that they've got to get rid of this worthless paper money because it's only going to continue to deteriorate. And so they are anxious to turn it in for anything. You got a rake? I don't even have a lawn. I'll take your rake. How many paper dollars will you take? What do you have? Oh, you have a porcelain statue of a dog? I'll take it. Here's my paper money. I mean, it doesn't matter what it is. People will be converting paper money for real tangible stuff as fast as they possibly can to get their hands on stuff, because even a porcelain dog may have some value, but the paper money will have none. This period is called the crack-up boom. And when conditions, Dr. Mises says, when conditions are the same as they have been in the past, and the Continental Congress, not worth a continental currency thing, in the revolutionary France, in Weimar Republic Germany, and in Zimbabwe recently, in Argentina, when conditions are the same, then the crack-up boom will take place. Well, conditions are developing that way here in the United States. Now, here is my theory that you can tell how bad it's been. Look, the revolutionary France inflation was really brutal. It was really bloody. I mean, the mobs would round people up in the streets. Farmers would be sent out to, would be locked up while the commandos from the cities went out and stole their goods. It was an awful, brutal period. Public executions, the guillotine was the entertainment of the day.
Yeah, because you weren't holding to the price controls or
well,
something.
It
You're
wasn't,
the problem.
It wasn't that way with the Continental Congress, the not worth a continental inflation here in the United States. It was an economic debacle, but it didn't turn into the bloodshed that revolutionary France did. So I have a theory that you can tell in advance how severe the currency crisis will be based on the cluelessness and the recklessness of the governing classes as you enter into it. And by that standard, Ernie, by that standard, this one's going to be very severe. And I'll give you just two quick points. If you look at it on the fiscal side is Congress and its spending habits, and they take in money and they spend money, tax collection, tax spending. If you look on the fiscal side, the fiscal authorities, in the face of burgeoning indebtedness, in the face of national insolvency, what do? They create another huge entitlement program, bigger than all the rest. And we just saw the news last week that, surprise, surprise, the healthcare program that was passed by Congress is going to cost a lot more than anybody ever suspected. So on the fiscal side,
I hadn't a clue.
They're acting with a recklessness that is dangerous. What about on the monetary side? What about the monetary officials, the Federal Reserve? In the face of a coming currency crisis of enormous proportions, what do? They've even continued into the last week participating in more of this with the support for the euro and the currency swaps and creation of more money and taking on more trash paper onto the balance sheet of the Fed. So if I am correct, you can tell the severity of the currency crisis before us by the cluelessness, the recklessness behavior of the fiscal and monetary authorities as it approaches. That means that during the crisis itself, they're going to continue to be clueless and reckless. That means that this will be a very, very severe one.
In the past, they've been able to blame the merchant, where it actually, somebody's got to go pay the gazillion dollars. Well, obviously, it's his fault because, he's the one that put the price tag on. So they blame that guy. Well, with the internet and the information that we have now, I'm wondering how long or how well that's going
to
work.
It always seems to work. I don't know if this will make a big difference. Maybe it'll lessen the effectiveness of it somewhat. But look, I'll tell you, you see it going on right now in Venezuela. They, Hugo Chavez and his socialist programs have caused huge price increases. I think the annual inflation rate, as measured by the government, is something like 30% right now. I mean, just this month, it's 30% annual inflation rate. Prices are going up by 30% a year. They've got a huge currency crisis beginning to develop in Venezuela right now. What has he begun to do? Blame the speculators. He's using this technology of the iPhone and technology of instant messaging and technology of people with cell phone cameras to find merchants who aren't abiding by the price guidelines and turn them into the national police, turn them into the brown shirts so that they can be dealt with appropriately. So this technology can play both ways too. But that's what they're doing in Venezuela.
That just, hastens the fall.
And it makes it brutal too.
Well, and you think they're going to go brutal here?
You can't tell today.
Because the states, that's one of the things that, one of the benefits of this concept of even having sovereign states, because a lot of these other countries are not made up of, as well-defined separate states, where the United States.
You tell me where there's a sovereign state. I don't see any sovereign states.
In our freaking head.
All right.
And that's kind of my point, is that there's going to be, in addition to Montana doing, we're going to do guns, we're going to make, Arizona said we're going to make freon, nobody else can, we went through that, we could do concealed carry without permits, we're going to papers please everybody, and whatever. I mean, there's this idea that there are states. The reason Karen Johnson, Senator, and I, we worked together and we got passed, and a lot of people don't remember this, what was passed is that for celebrating our centennial in 2012, we're minting Arizona gold bullion, and it's going to be, commemorative medallions, 1 ounce. They want, oh, you can't. Okay, we'll call it a commemorative medallion. Well, in Arizona, the treasury, the state treasurer is responsible for Arizona minting their own gold. Does that become transferable, pay off something, do it. Oh, no, you're not allowed. Well, then when are you allowed? What did California do? Had nothing to do with the federal government. They go in, they said, you know what? We're going to give you these IOUs to all our vendors because we can't afford to pay. And they go, oh, okay. Well, we'll pay our state taxes with that. No. You can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, so this is, there's all kinds of different things that are being done to transfer of debt obligations. They're already doing it. It's just what's going to be accepted. And sooner or later, it's going to come down to just people going, you know what I accept? Pre-1964 silver coins, man. That's what I accept. Yeah. And I'm going to price my stuff accordingly. We already started doing that here. We have, you know, once a month, they have a little park and swap thing here. And that's what they do. They do everything from the 1792 Coin Act is silver. A dollar is valued at 0.77 ounces of silver equals $1. And they take all these pre-1964 silver coin, junk silver, and they go, yep, and they price everything here and lawnmowers. And I bought a welder and we get all kinds, you know, based on $28 for a welder. Well, of course it was, you know, in silver. But the thing is that this is how I see it coming because there's such an immediate demand for it. And there's the information that instantaneously it'd be Craigslist. You know, I mean, it's just going to have, in fact, one of the guys here created a eBay Craigslist. He's a big Intel Uber computer geek guy. And he puts on there what denomination of what currency. It could be Federal Reserve note, grams of gold, ounces of silver. We can do it now. The technology is here. Now they're doing these Berkshires in Pennsylvania Valley where they're trading, you know, their own currency in America in a valley in Pennsylvania for years. And it's 90% of the funds you can get transferred at the bank. You know, it's like a coupon or something. This kind of solutions of the American people are being offered up everywhere. But they don't want that kind of solution. Hmm. Who will be the person saying that?
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Open up your mind and let me step inside.
Yeah, we're going to step inside. We're going to try and educate you on what's coming because it's time. You know, we're in the last segment here, and I want to talk about what we were talking about last segment. It's going to go. And when it does, there's a lot of solutions. The American people, humanity will march on. We could, you know, like that. It'd be better off. It's get rid, cast off this monkey off my back. Get this vampire off my neck. You know, we're done. Get this parasite, you know, out from under my arm. Get that 400-pound tick off my back. I mean, you know, we could do this in overnight, but then we wouldn't need them. And their main priority is, whoa, time out, homie. You're not going to be able to do what you want without us, you know, having the shiny badge guy with the available gun telling you what's what. Because, you know, if we don't have you on our plantation, well, how are we going to survive? You know, we're going to suck the host dry. I don't know where they go after that, but, you know, so that's the question I have for Charles is, once this really goes, what's the role the government is going to play? You know, they're still going to try and what?
Well, they discredit themselves in a currency collapse. So they become, they typically become more overbearing, more interfering, rely on more and more brute force rather than more and more gentleness or persuasion. It becomes an issue of force rather than persuasion. And it's just a question of how much the people are willing to put up with. You know, as the government needs money to keep its promises, to keep themselves in power, they become brutal in extracting revenue from people. You know, is it going to get to the point where they start busting down the doors? I don't know. Will the American people put up with it? I don't know. I don't know.
You know, I'm wondering if that's busting down the doors is going to get them because we're in a different society. I mean, it's your wealth is off somewhere else, or they don't need your, you know, assistance, acquiescence, or whatever. They just take it. You know, it's your deed. We nationalize everything, all property. Heck, that's what Fannie and Freddie did anyway.
Well, I mean, you know, look at it. What happens when suddenly, you know, there's a bank holiday and the president announces that your safety deposit box has to be opened in the presence of a bank inspector.
You know, they've done it before.
A lot of people have, you know, precious gems and jewels and family heirlooms and precious metals in a safety deposit box. And what happens when they say this has to be, you know, I don't think it's going to end up like that. I'll tell you, I think it's a lot more effective for, instead of them, you know, coin dealers use this fear all the time with people. You know, you got to buy these old coins because they won't nationalize these. But the truth is, they can nationalize anything they want. I don't think they're going to nationalize the coins.
They're just going to keep inflating.
And they're going to get, they're already today, you are taxed at a higher rate for gold and silver than you are anything else. You own stock in British Petroleum, you own stock in Starbucks, you own stock in Pepsi Cola. You're taxed at one rate. You own gold and silver. You're taxed at a punitive rate to punish that behavior. So the system is already in place, and they can use the tax collectors already exist. The tax reporting mechanism is already in place. They don't need. Here's something that a lot of gold bugs don't really understand. When the government nationalized the gold back in 1932 and 1933, it was really more about devaluing the dollar than it was taking the gold. They didn't need all the gold. They didn't take that gold because they needed the money. In the Soviet Union, when they were pulling people's toenails out to get them to reveal whether they needed the gold. Here in the United States, the whole point was to devalue the dollar. They couldn't devalue the dollar if it was tied to gold. Today, the dollar is not tied to gold or anything else. And so every day it's devalued. But in those days, the existence of gold in the hands of the people and a gold standard created an impediment. They could not devalue the dollar as long as that existed, which is why they nationalized the gold.
They made it. They demanded you turn it in. You could not open your safe deposit box without a treasury agent there. They took all the gold. They gave you $20 for it, and overnight almost it went to $35. And they said, thank you for playing.
Yes, you've been fleeced.
You know,
hope you enjoyed it.
It was, and of course, then you talk about bad money driving out good. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening. I mean, when you have bad money, I mean, of course, it's, I'm not going to have my 64 dime that's worth $1.30, $1.40, whatever it is, dollar, you know, $2.
Well, Ernie, look at it this way.
Spend it on, you know, as a dime.
Look, we're sitting here talking about the United States dollar, but in Zimbabwe, where they were printing money to beat the band, the dollar was their backup option. In other words, you know, if you could get your hands on U.S. dollars, you could save money for a week or so without it, you know, the purchasing power of the money totally disappearing. You know, because the Zimbabwe currency was deteriorating so fast, it was being inflated so rapidly that, you know, prices were going up faster than between when you got paid and when you could get to the store. Prices would increase and put you out of the buyer's market. So they were happy to have U.S. dollars. And this has gone on around the world. I mean,
that's what's going on now.
In Argentina. But the problem is that there is no backup currency to the dollar. There is no backup governmental, national currency. There's no euro, there's no Zimbabwe dollar, there is no national currency that is the currency of the reserve, that if the euro goes crazy, when it happens, the dollar is no place else to go.
Well, that's why the dollar's strong now, is because they just put $1 trillion pinky swear on, you know, what are they going to do with the euro, and you know what, I think we need to be going over to the dollar. And then what happens when they, you know, that's done? You know, the dollar, they're going to go to what? So that's what I want to ask you, is that we're going to be in a situation, it's going to be, I think they're always going, they always drag it out for one more what? One more election cycle, okay? One more election. So we're going to have bad sales reporting from this Christmas, if it even goes that long. We're going to have, you know, all kinds of screaming and machinations of whatever, okay? So we're going to be in a situation to where it goes. There's nowhere else to go. The dollar is what's backing that up. And then the man is going to be, well, we have a solution. We got, you know, pinky swear. Here's our new whatever. I can't contemplate any other solution other than freedom that they're going to go other than a world currency. I don't, and you mentioned that a lot of economists, they go, oh, that would never happen. And I'm going, why would you even say that?
Well, look at the euro as an example. What was the justification for the euro? The justification was you had all of these nation states with their own currencies, all, abutting and adjoining one another. You had people that, you know, were traveling. You could go from Belgium to the Netherlands to Germany to France in no time at all. And you got all these competing currencies and life is complicated. And everything's very complex. We need one currency. So instead of going to the one currency that has already existed, in existence, the one currency that is the most liquid commodity, the one currency with a 5,000-year history of serving as a good store of value, instead of going to a gold standard where, you know, an ounce of gold in German terms is an ounce of gold in France, is an ounce of gold in Belgium, instead of solving the problem, they decided to create a super irredeemable paper currency and put them all under one umbrella. And look how it's worked.
Well, how did the Swiss get involved in this thing? I thought they were one of the standouts. They're like, no, we don't want to play. How did that get sucked in?
Well, because they are, like others, they loaned money to places like Greece. Swiss bankers loaned money to places like Greece and Spain and Portugal and Italy to bad debtors, to people with bad credit ratings. So they, you know, the Swiss bankers lend money, American bank. Nobody has talked about how deeply, how up to their eyes in exposure American banks are to Greek debt. But I'll bet you if you look closely at Morgan Stanley, Morgan Stanley, if you look closely, no, I'll tell you who you look at.
Morgan Stanley is a good example.
Look at any of them. You'll find that they have an enormous exposure to this stuff. And it may be as shareholders in French banks, German banks. I mean, that's how they got to Angela Merkel in Germany. She said, no, you know, we're not going to do it. The German people are probably the most productive in Europe. You know, for every hour of labor, they are the most productive, biggest output of goods and services. So they look at in Greece, you've got government structures that allow people to retire at the age of 40 if they worked for the government. They get their salary for life or a good portion of it, medical care for life. It's just socialism gone nuts. And the German people say, wait a minute, I have to work till I'm 65 before I can retire. You're going to tax me to subsidize these louts in Greece who are taking all kinds of goodies and aren't as productive as we are. They didn't want anything to do with it. And Angela Merkel said, yeah, we're not going to participate. We're not going to, and the German people didn't want to bail out. But all of a sudden, it's just like in the United States. Who really has the clout? It's the banks. And the German banks and the French banks that have exposure to Greek debt, they don't want to eat the losses. They made these loans. They were going to get to keep the profit. But now there's the prospect of loss on the loans that they made, the bad loans they made to Greece. So they get to keep the profits, but they socialize the loss.
You know, we had Gary Johnson. He was governor of New Mexico, and he's probably going to run for president as a Republican. And he was in studio a few weeks ago, and he was telling me the story of in New Mexico, the law enforcement, they'll start within a few years. They're making $50,000, $60,000, $80,000 a year. And they're there for 20 years. They're, you know, 40 years old or something. And they're getting like 80% of their salary.
Yeah, that's unbelievable.
And he goes, well, what'd you think was going to happen? So I don't know what to offer you other than the information. You know, the audience, I just want to make sure that you know that we know that it's going down. But that doesn't mean that American heritage can't rear its head again and solve the problem. But you have to understand what the problem is. The problem is we are not in control of our property, our labor, our liberty, our lives. When we seize control of our lives again, we will be able to seize control of our future and that of our children and grandchildren. It's inevitable, and it's hopefully going to be daisies and gun barrels, because the alternative is messy.